This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Once again, it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla. It's a segment wherein we answer your questions. Your questions can be sent to us, of course, to radioprogram@AOL.com. That's pretty easy. Radioprogram@AOL.com gets your questions to us, and then it may be a week or two before we catch up and are able to answer your questions. How are you doing today, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Very, very well. And for those of you new to the Intelligent Medicine Q&A with Layla segment, Layla Mutin is the nutritionist that I work side by side with every week at our practice here in Manhattan. She's a registered dietitian, and she also holds a master's degree in the field of nutrition. And so, let's see, what's in the news this week? Anything that grabbed you?
I can't say. Yeah. I don't think so. It's been a pretty quiet summer news-wise on the health front, with maybe, you know, the whole coconut oil is bad for us nonsense.
That's the latest brouhaha, yeah. You know, with the American Heart Association doubling down on its recommendation that we eliminate saturated fats. I've been doing a little bit of work for a project where I'm going to be doing a webinar for health professionals. Unfortunately, this is not for just lay people, but I've been doing a lot of research on nutrition and gallbladder disease. And so there's a lot to be said in terms of ways to prevent gallbladder disease.
And oh, yeah. Don't go on a non-fat diet.
Exactly.
You'll get gallstones.
you're giving it away, because that was actually...
I'm sorry.
Something that I'm going to feature in an article coming up, which is myths about gallbladder disease. And one of the myths is that you need to be on a low-fat diet if you've got gallbladder disease, or even after removal of a gallbladder. That, I think, is one of those shibboleths that we're going to try and demolish. Let's see. We shared some recipes from the fresh-pressed olive oil site, one of our good sponsors, and we're getting a lot of response on that this week. We did a segment, a very, very interesting segment, on neuroplasticity last week. And that was quite interesting, because we talked about nutrients like niacel. Niacel, or nicotinamide riboside, may play a role in restoring brain metabolism after an injury, say a concussion or traumatic brain injury, or a neurodegenerative disease. So that was an interesting segment we did this week. So, you know, in spite of the fact that maybe there's, it's kind of a summer lull and there's a little bit of a dearth of news, we still managed to include some updates. We had an interesting update this week. Lutein. What do you associate lutein with, you know, when you think about it as a nutrient?
Eyes, eye health.
Exactly.
Found in egg yolks.
Right, exactly. So, new study. This is in the journal. Actually, not in the journal. It's in a summary website, sciencedaily.com. Researchers at University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. I always thought it was Champaign-Urbana, but anyway. It's... It's the big campus of the University of Illinois that's not in Chicago. And it turns out that lutein may counter cognitive aging. How about that?
Wow.
So, hey, you know, makes sense. Wow. If it protects the eyes, those are nerves. It protects the brain. And so, however, they say lutein found in leafy greens may counter cognitive aging. Well, they do note later in the article, a few lines down, that it's present in eggs.
Yeah.
But actually, eggs really trump, sorry to use that expression so frequently, trump green leafy vegetables as a source of lutein and zeaxanthin. So, you know, then so they tell you, you know, you got cardiovascular risk, stop eating eggs, absolutely, and take a statin. So what's that going to do? It's going to interfere with your lutein absorption and possibly affect not only your eyes, but your brain. Okay?
Mm.
So.
Not good. Yeah.
Great. Well. All right. Let's move along to questions. What have we from our listeners this week?
Okay. We've got a question from Larry. Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I've been hearing some negative reviews of metformin lately. Have you? Please let us know what you think.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not on it, but it would be my go-to if needed, since Dr. Hoffman has spoken so highly of it in the past. You know, Dr. Hoffman, as a nutritionist, two drugs that I really, 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 really like. One is metformin. Do you want to guess what the other one is?
Thyroid?
Low-dose naltrexone.
Oh, okay. But thyroid could be up there, right? Because at least
it could be up there, absolutely. Because, sure.
How about testosterone? That would be a prescription medication that could actually play a role in restoration, and it is natural. So, yeah, I like low-dose naltrexone, of course, for autoimmunity and many inflammatory disorders, neurodegenerative disorders, colitis, MS, and so on. Coming back to metformin, what is metformin? Metformin is actually, it is actually originally pioneered as a copycat of a constituent of an herb called goat's rue, R-U. And it has blood sugar stabilizing effects without the negative effects of a lot of the oral blood sugar lowering agents, which may lower blood sugar excessively. And the net result is that you crave carbohydrates and put on weight. And metformin has actually been associated with some degree of weight loss, even in people who are just a little insulin resistant, not particularly diabetic. I think one of its downsides is that it depletes vitamin B12, so you have to look out for that.
Yes.
Nutritional interaction.
It's easy to supplement enough with some vitamin B12 of taking metformin.
Go ahead. Please.
Yeah. One of the things I think is that's most exciting, I know you do too, is metformin for cancer prevention.
Yes. And it's interesting. I had a conversation with an oncologist the other day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was saying that I use it. And, you know, this guy is an expert. He does cancer surgery and he does chemotherapy. And I asked him, does he think that metformin has a role? And this guy is, you know, maybe unlike some perhaps narrow-minded oncologists. This guy's on top of all the research. He's a top, top guy, brilliant intellect. He got through medical school in like 2.5 years, and he was open to the use of metformin, but he said that at some of the latest conferences, he said, we used to use it all the time a few years back, but at some of the latest conferences, the results of research on metformin were less than spectacular. In other words, it's still worth considering for cancer, but it wasn't like a knockout. But he was open to it. And what appears what it does is it does something to the sugar metabolism of cancer. We know that cancer depends on sugars for proliferation to some extent, sugar and other nutrients. And by reducing insulin resistance, it seems to favor cancer outcomes, not as standalone, but, you know, maybe as an adjunct to prostate cancer treatment, breast cancer treatment, perhaps. And I have several of our patients on metformin. I just added a metformin to the regimen of one of our prostate cancer patients this week. Side effects, it can cause some gastrointestinal hurry up kind of thing, but that is often transient as you get used to it. But what's interesting is that it is thought that to some extent the efficacy of metformin is mediated via changes that it can create in the microbiome. which is fascinating. Mm. That's how it may alter the metabolism. It may work in multiple ways, but at least one of the ways is that it may change the bacterial composition of the gut, thus rendering the metabolism less prone to insulin resistance. So, yeah, you know, maybe that's part of what makes it work. One of the oldest medications around. Interestingly, that medication was actually banned in the United States for a while. I believe it was in the 70s because of concern that some people developed lactic acidosis. And it was found that the people who are prone to lactic acidosis when they take metformin are usually very, very sick hospitalized patients. So a patient who's maybe in the intensive care unit, who is, you know, at death's door, that it may not be a good idea to give that patient metformin. But I very few side effects that I can see in metformin.
Right, right. And for those who don't get over the side effect of having very loose stools or diarrhea or hurry, I like that word, the extended release metformin is often better tolerated than the standard metformin. Yeah,
more expensive.
Metformin is also used.
More expensive, but helpful.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's also used associated with PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, because that's also, you know, the hallmark of that particular condition is insulin resistance.
It will relieve infertility. Some women who are unable to conceive who have PCOS, I've seen it in one patient of ours who had a lot of trouble with infertility when she began taking metformin. And of course, in accompaniment with diet and certain supplements, she became pregnant. One other thing about metformin that's kind of cool. There is, I follow this because this is my alma mater, my medical school, Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Up there in the Bronx, there happen to be a lot of old Jews. It's just, you know, from the old neighborhood in the Bronx. And they are in their 80s and 90s, and some are in their hundreds. So there's this phenomenon among Ashkenazic Jews, Eastern European Jews, and who are very prey to many medical conditions. They have unusual conditions like Tay-Sachs disease and so on, higher incidence of breast cancer, colon cancer, colitis, Crohn's disease, and all these sort of things that may have to do with some degree of inbreeding. But they also have a fairly high number of individuals who have extraordinary longevity. And I have a few of those individuals in my family. My grandfather lived to be 101. I know, people who live into their 90s and beyond. So a guy at Einstein, his name is Dr. Jacques Barzelay, he's been written up in the New York Times Magazine, has undertaken a study. What's going on with these people? Why are they so able to live a long time? And why do they have longevity genes? But an arm of the study is to give healthy 80-year-olds, even without diabetes, metformin, and to see and to compare them to people getting a placebo pill to see if indeed there's some life-extending effects of metformin. So interesting medication, and it may, you know, it may turn out to have ancillary benefits in cancer and longevity as opposed to just blood sugar control.
That's fascinating. I can't. You know, the only negative, what Larry's asking about, negative reviews, I've not read any. I'm thinking maybe just the side effects and possible deficiency of B12, which is very easily remedied, because the benefit really outweighs the risk in using this medication, I think, for those conditions that you mentioned. So, yeah, I'm still a fan of metformin.
You know, I just Googled rethinking metformin. Okay. And there are a couple of articles where they thought it might be helpful in heart failure. And so there's an article entitled Time to Rethink Metformin in Heart Failure. And metformin in chronic kidney disease. Well, okay. That's where you have a risk of lactic acidosis. But they actually say the risk is not increased in metformin treated patients. So that's rethinking the harmful effects. Diabetes drugs may do more harm than good. They say that metformin side effects tend to be mild and temporary. So, you know, the rethink, I don't know, there's not a lot of rethink. The rethink is mostly assuring us of the safety.
Right. And so many of the diabetes meds not similar to metformin are really triggering more insulin secretion in an effort to bring blood sugar down. But then we're having to feed the insulin.
Yep. Yep.
That's why people are getting hungry and getting fat.
Yeah. What we want are drugs and supplements that actually increase insulin sensitivity. So things that do them, exercise does that wonderfully. It'd be nice if there was the exercise pill in a bottle, but people have got to, you know, do it and sweat, you know, like I did this morning in, you know, it was like 90% humidity. And it wasn't the heat that got me, it was the humidity that got me when I did my run this morning. But so that's, you know, then there's, you know, chromium, and then there's berberine, which actually toe-to-toe, matched up against metformin, slightly different mode of action. It seems to work as well. So, you know, there's a
And they can work synergistically.
They do.
I know they can work synergistically, too.
Yep.
Yeah, we also like, yes, you mentioned chromium, you mentioned CM Core. I'm thinking of diaxanol as well as is another nice...
By the way, these are brand names. These are supplements available to patients and listeners via FullScript, which is our... which is our dispensary in the cloud. Basically, we no longer have a physical dispensary where we pack boxes. We have FullScript as our fulfillment service. And go there, you know, sign up, check it out, investigate, see if some of the products that you want to access are available there. All right. Let's take another question, please.
Okay. We've got an email from Nancy. Hello, love your show. Was wondering if you might know of a way to get a doctor to give me a B12 shot. How low do my levels need to be to get one?
That's interesting.
The doctor won't even give my 80-year-old neighbor a shot.
Yeah.
They're certainly not dangerous.
Well, this is really interesting. This is a very interesting question because B12 shots used to be a mainstay of doctors in the, I don't know, 50s, 60s, 70s. And they used to do it just sort of like, hey, you want a B12 shot? You know, it's like, without necessarily checking. And they recognize that B12 shots could be therapeutic for people who don't even have B12 deficiency. So that was what you call empirical therapy. In other words, you know, take a dart and throw it at the target and hope you get a bullseye.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people, it was beneficial. Or maybe there was a placebo component, but it was like the proverbial shot in the arm or the shot in the butt in some cases. And it's actually been demonstrated that individuals who have normal B12 get an incremental benefit from B12 shots in terms of energy sometimes. Now, what's happened is with the new, shall we say, evidence-based or stringent medicine of today, they now have established guidelines, and these guidelines are obviously enforced by the insurance industry and government reimbursers, that you have to meet certain criteria in order to get reimbursement for certain therapies. So in order to get B12 shots, you have to demonstrate that, A, you have a very low B12, abysmally low, and we tend to think of the cutoff as much higher. You know, we worry about people who have a B12 of 325. They say it's got to be 180 or lower. Yeah, and or inability to restore B12 with oral B12 supplementation. Yeah. Now, a fair number of people who have low B12, either due to dietary restriction or due to the fact that they're on PPIs and like acid blockers and they malabsorb, they can restore B12.
And as we get older, we lose our intrinsic factor.
Yes.
Which is necessary for properly absorbing B12. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So I think that just happens naturally with age as well, and that's why maybe so many elderly are low.
Right. So
hence Nancy's desire for a B12 shot.
So very formally speaking, what will happen is a doctor may do like a very sophisticated workup and say, gee, this person's B12 is low. They eat animal protein in their diet, and they take a B12 oral supplement. And even if they take it sublingually, it may not raise their B12. So let's do what are called antiparietal antibodies. Those are tests to look at the parietal, which secretes intrinsic factor. And if there's antibodies to that, which is a little structure in the stomach that secretes intrinsic factor, bingo, you've got that diagnosis. You can present it to the insurer and say, it's justified to give this person B12 shots. How do you convince a doctor who's trained a certain way, and who's also under certain quality control, they call it, standards, yeah, which are actually sort of constraints about resource allocation. You know, B12 shots,
yeah,
are, shall we say, you know, superfluous, they think. How do you convince them to go beyond that? Well, I do B12 shots sometimes empirically in people who are tired, and we see if they respond, especially if they start with low B12. I generally, you know, because of the hassle factor of getting B12 shots, I mean, you can come to the office and get them. That's long distance for some people and expensive. You can also self-administer, but mm-hmm, not everybody is comfortable with giving themselves a shot in the butt.
Which is right, the or they could have their spouse or significant other do it, you know.
Or if they have someone with any, yeah, modicum of medical experience in the, you know, immediate, their social network or family circle, they can get the shots administered. And
yeah,
that it, and it may help, and I underline may, results may vary.
Yes. Interesting. Nancy, best of luck. Maybe you need to go to another doctor.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. All right. Thank you, Nancy, for your question. We have a question from Cheryl. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I just listened to the podcast on OsteoStrong exercise treatment for osteoporosis. I was quite impressed with the results yield from this therapy. I live in Jersey, so there are no facilities in my area. I do have osteoporosis now at a negative 2.5. Mm-hmm. Would going to the gym and doing weight training 3 times a week be enough to do it?
The answer is it wouldn't hurt.
It wouldn't hurt, right?
It may not be as precisely geared towards the loading that OsteoStrong is designed to offer.
Right. Right, which is interesting, but I think any strength training, mm-hmm, is going to be helpful.
Yeah.
I wouldn't see why not. And getting, you know, having a good diet, getting rid of the sugar in your life, eating ample amounts of protein, mm-hmm, so you have those branched-chain amino acids to help you rebuild muscle and stress your muscles, right, and stress your skeleton via the ligaments and all of that good stuff. But 3 times a week is actually optimal, mm-hmm, rather than 2x a week, according to the research, to really help maintain and build lean body mass. Mm-hmm. So,
and apropos of that, you know, I was going to tee off on an article that I saw in the New York Times. The teaser was, how much protein do you need to eat? And I thought, well, that's interesting, because that's a really interesting topic. And it was about 3 paragraphs long, and it stated the standard recommendation that you get, I don't know, 40, 50 grams of protein per day, or, you know, 60 if you're male, 60, 70. I don't even know what it was. Because, you
right,
know, as
right,
a nutritionist, I think you memorized this in, you know,
yes, it's
in dietitian
0.8
school.
Grams.
Right.
Right, 0.8 grams per kilogram, but it
which
should
is
actually be higher.
Inadequate, yep. Which is inadequate. And then they said, but you have to be careful because of kidney function. And that's that old saw about, if you take too much protein, you'll destroy your kidneys. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, there's like some science writer who maybe got, you know, took one, biology class in college, and they assigned this guy or this gal to write an article without any expertise whatsoever on the subject, with no sound bites or quotes from people, and not exploring the controversies, because it has been alleged that too much protein causes osteoporosis, but that's actually a shibboleth. That's actually a misnomer. Not true.
Yes.
Protein actually supports bone formation, because bone is not just minerals. It's proteinaceous, and you need some protein. Yeah.
In fact, the latest research reveals that a woman 25 years of age needs less protein than a woman my age.
Yeah.
And 53, or women in their 60s. We need more protein as we get older to maintain that lean body mass and the skeletal strength. So,
because there is this phenomenon of sarcopenia, and I think also as one ages, one's digestive strength is reduced. Sometimes appetite is impaired. People tend to go for jazzier, sweet things. I mean, I sometimes, go by, pastry places, and I see, you know, especially in the afternoon, you see, like, that's when the ladies meet and they have their little pastry. Well, I'm thinking, this is, you're displacing your appetite, you know, by eating empty calories when you could be eating something that's nutritionally valuable with some protein, but, you know, having that lemon meringue pie isn't going to really deliver adequate protein to your muscles, and you're just going to get more fat, less muscles, and the result is not good.
Yeah. And then I really worry about the elderly patient, literally, typically an old a female who's just having tea and toast.
Yeah.
And that's not enough of anything or any nutrition at all. So it's,
And, you know, aging affects the taste buds, and medications affect the taste buds. And it's even been thought that an early sign of dementia is more of a desire for jazzy, sweet tastes and, you know, less, you know, eat your broccoli and, you know, your meat portion.
And also the ability to feel thirsty diminishes as we age. And that's a reminder to everyone out there, especially on these very hot days, that you need to sip water all day long. It's just the best idea. You don't have to guzzle it, but you must sip water all day long. It's just a good idea to do. Yeah.
All right. Timely advice. What's coming up in part two? Because we're going to divide these podcasts into
part
two parts.
Rachel asks, what is the best form of vitamin C for arterial health?
Okay, we'll tackle that question when we return. Today, it's our weekly Q&A with Layla, part of our Intelligent Medicine podcast series. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We'll be right back.